we finished the last session talking about the subject of idols and images, why God said we're not to make them. One reason is because no image, whatever you make it of, no image is ever going to be adequate to be a representation of God. Why did they choose two golden calves? Why didn't they, you know, choose a camel or a fish or something? You know, why a calf? There are one or two things about the calf. First of all, gold obviously speaks about wealth and at least something sort of dignified about it. A calf was the strongest thing that they knew. See, back then, if you wanted to plow your field up or something, caterpillar had not yet been invented, and bulldozers, and tractors, and John Deere, and all that lot. And the strongest thing they knew was a bull calf, and it would pull the plow for them. And they admired the calf for its strength. It was useful for its strength. Also, the calf was their biggest unit of money. They calculated their money basically in terms of animals. And the animal that was worth more than any other animal was a bull calf. So they made two golden calves representing God, prosperity, and strength. And the thing that they liked about God was his strength. His power had brought them out from Egypt. And they recognized that, and they wanted help from the strength of God. So the calves, they chose to be a symbol. But you see, a calf isn't particularly intelligent, is it? I'm reminded of days when I taught a course at Cavenary Hall in personal evangelism, and I'd given the students texts to learn by heart that were going to be useful to them. And one of them goes like this: "Come now, let us reason together, saith the Lord. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow." Isaiah 1:18. And they were going all over the place, all over the castle, and all over the grounds, muttering to themselves these verses. And we had an old cow at that time called Daffodil. She was a sort of farm's pet, really. And he was learning a little bit about dairy cattle from having one, thinking he might have a few more. And Daffodil was a particularly stupid old cow, and she looked particularly stupid. And on one occasion, as I was walking through the parkland at Cambridge, I saw a very hyper-spiritual student, desperately serious about anything, leaning against the fence. And Daffodil was on the other side with her big stupid eyes just a couple of feet away from this particular highly spiritual student, and about 2 feet of drool hanging from her wet muzzle. And he was saying, "Come now, let us reason together." Daffodil's response to that was to raise her tail and do what cows do when they raise their tail. And they're not the most intelligent of creatures, particularly. And a bull is not a moral animal. It's not immoral, it's amoral. It doesn't have any morals. It doesn't break the morals it's got, so it's not immoral, it's amoral, no morals. And the average bull has 300 or 400 wives in a good year, and keeps them all content. See, and this is the symbol that they chose to represent God. See? Strong, yes, and they respected his strength, but they didn't even think about his morals, and they didn't even think about his intelligence. And a calf was just something that they could manipulate to get done what they wanted done. And that's the symbol that they chose for God. And of course, a lot of people mentally substitute exactly the same image. We don't want instruction from God. We're not interested in the morality of God. We're just interested in a source of power greater than ourselves that we can manipulate. Are we all that different from them? Really? Listen to the average person, not the average person, the average Christian talking to God in the morning. Morning, Lord. Sorry I haven't got time to talk to you this morning. I'm late again. However, protect me on the way to work. Make sure I don't have an accident. And bless the family. And if I've got time, I'll talk to you when I get home. Nice, isn't it? Sort of slightly superior kind of servant. They treat him. I don't think he hears prayers like that, of course. But we're not all that different from them. We forget what it suits us to forget and pick out the bits that it suits us to remember. So that's how they began. They began worshipping like that. Now you always become like the thing you worship. So you would expect somebody worshipping a calf to perhaps become strong, but stupid, and without morals. And that's what began to happen. But unfortunately, he wasn't the calves weren't the only source of worship. These were the main idols that they worshipped. First of all, Baal. The plural of that in the Hebrew is the Baalim. And the word simply means master or owner. And everything had its own Baal, particularly every parcel of ground in their understanding, every little few acres, like his hill, would have its own Baal. And every other little bit of ground had its own Baal, its own owner, God that owned it. Now, if you were a farmer, and all of them were, and you wanted to get a good crop, and your livelihood depended on it, then you had to keep the Baal content. How did you keep the Baal content? Well, by worshipping him, of course. How did you do that? You took a sacrifice, and you went to one of his places of worship, and you brought your sacrifice, and there you met, this is what the men did, there you met with a temple prostitute, had ritual sex with a temple prostitute, left your sacrifice there and return, Baal was happy with you and you could expect a reasonably good crop. And what were their places of worship called? They were called high places, because many of them were on the hilltops where it's nice and cool, also groves or green trees. And you'll find those referred to again and again in the parts of the Old Testament, around Hosea, also Isaiah, Jeremiah, Micah, Amos, all the time when Baal worship was the fashion. So now you've not got amorality, you've got immorality. And every man was encouraged to commit ritual sex with a temple prostitute. Didn't do a lot for family life or the moral life of the nation as a whole. Now, Baal had a goddess, girlfriend, called, well, you might find a spelt like that, with or without an H. You might also find this one, which is more common in Hosea. You might find this one. Anyway, she was a sort of female equivalent to Baal. And the women went to worship her. See, and she pleased Baal, so that was a sort of sneaky way into the back door. And if you wanted to make absolutely sure of getting a good crop, then your husband went to the temple of Baal and had his fling there, and your wife went and worshipped at Asherah with the prostitute priests. So, it was a pretty interesting kind of culture. Then, the third one, major one, was called Molech. You'll find it variously spelt Malcolm, Milcom, same one. His name means the great king. I'll just mention to you a couple of places where you'll find specific references to that. 2 Kings 23:10 and Leviticus 18:21. His name means the great king, and he was a much bigger god than the Baals, and you needed to keep him happy because he could get very nasty if he was angry with you. And the way you kept him happy was by sacrificing your babies to him. See? And when when Molech was worshipped, it was one of two ways. Either it was a huge bronze image which started at the waist, and this massive, cruel head, and a big pair of hands. And you lit a fire, the hands were near the ground, you lit a fire underneath the hands. When they were red hot, you took your living baby and dropped it into the red hot hands, and Molech accepted his sacrifice and burned your baby up. The other way was to give the image a huge mouth, and the whole thing was hollow, had vents at the bottom, and you lit a fire inside. When you got a good big fire inside, then you threw your baby in through the mouth, and it landed on the fire inside and was burned alive. So those were the three forms of worship, and most common in Hosea's time. Or the four, we ought to say. The golden cows, the Baals, Ashtaroth, and Molech. So what will the nation become like if they become like the things they worship? Molech is cruel and merciless, pitiless. Baals and Ashtaroth, they're immoral, and the calves are stupid. Very little bit more history. Now get this right. Jeroboam the first, son of Nebat, is the first king of the separated tribe of kingdom of Israel. The 10 tribes. Okay? His counterpart is Rehoboam. 1st king of Judah. Jeroboam the first is a very bad king. He made the whole nation to sin. Every king after him is compared back to Jeroboam the first, who made Israel to sin. Every king of Judah, on the other hand, is compared back to David, who was the model king, the good king. And, of course, they're all descended from David's line, and Jesus himself came down from that line. But we're just going down about 200 years. Okay, 200 years. To Jeroboam the second. And over on this side, there is King Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah. Put those two together, because for 10 years they both ruled. Uzziah, at the end of his life, had leprosy for 10 years, and Jotham reigned instead, and then he took over the throne, his son, then Ahaz, son of Jotham, then Hezekiah. And this is Hosea's time. He's prophesying in that time. And Hosea is a prophet in the northern kingdom, not in the southern kingdom, where they held to the true worship of God. and they still had the temple and the Levites. He is the prophet up here in this northern lot, this heathen lot, with all their idolatry, etc. And we said what a nation would probably become if they worshipped things like that. Turn now, if you would, to Hosea chapter 4. Hosea chapter 4. Hear the word of the Lord, you Israelites, because the Lord has a charge to bring against you who live in the land. There is no faithfulness. Sorry, I'll give you time to get there. Halfway down the first verse. There is no faithfulness. Well, you wouldn't expect to be with the kind of worship that they had, would you? No faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land. There is only cursing, lying, and murder, stealing, and adultery. They break all bounds. It doesn't matter what standards you set, it doesn't matter how slack and permissive and low they are, wherever you set them, they'll break them. They break all bounds. And bloodshed follows bloodshed. Literally in the Hebrew it says this, blood touches blood. And the picture is very vivid. You go to the street and murder is so frequent that one pool of blood merges with the next one. Blood touches blood. And it was like that amongst the common people. It was also like that amongst the kings. None of the kings died peacefully in this era. They were all murdered, and somebody else snatched power from them. Just imagine what was that was like. Let's look at verse 2 again. There is only cursing, lying, and murder, stealing, and adultery. They break all bounds, and bloodshed follows bloodshed. Cursing is no respect for God. Lying, no respect for truth. Murder, no respect for life. Stealing, no respect for property. Adultery, no respect for family life. Every single barrier is broken. Verse 3, because of this, the land itself mourns, and all who live in it waste away. The beasts of the field, and the birds of the air, and the fish of the sea are dying. That's an awfully up-to-date picture. Within your lifetime, at least 2,000 separate species have been annihilated from the earth by the greed and irresponsibility of man. The profit motive, the big dollar, or the big pound, big mark. And the land itself is in mourning. We're in danger of destroying our own environment. Imagine what a land could be like if there was no faithfulness in it. There was no love to be found and no acknowledgement of God. So that's the way it was. That was the setting in which Hosea was called to be a prophet. And it may be the kind of setting in which some of us will be called upon to minister. And so Hosea is a pretty up-to-date figure. Certain parts of our major cities wouldn't be particularly out of the way to describe them just like that, would it? No faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God. Just cursing, people swear in your country, lying, murder. You know, when I come over here, a lot of people ask me about Northern Ireland. why are the people killing each other all the time? Do you know there are more violent deaths in Chicago in a year than there are in Northern Ireland? There are also more in Houston, San Francisco, New York, Toronto. Not all that different a setting. Of course, we might like to keep to our nice little Christian enclaves and never venture out into the mission field. But some of us will, and will be called upon maybe to reach the same kind of people that Hosea was called upon to work with. Now, let's open to chapter 1, verse 1, and let's make a start. Chapter 1, verse 1, the word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, it's got nothing whatever to do with beer, during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the reign of Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel. So now we've got it in context, we've already told you who those are. You can look up those kings if you wish, their reigns, quite interesting. 2 Kings 16 and following will give you an account of them. First of all, the names. And there's a name, Hosea. Might just give you a test on Hosea, I don't know yet. Depends how time goes. Means God saves. Quite a nice name. Every name in Hebrew means something. They're not just labels. Every one of them means something. Very often, looking it up in a good concordance, say like a Young's or in a Bible dictionary, will give you the meaning of the name, and it will be usually instructive. Not every time, but very often it will bring something alive for you. His dad was called Beeri. A little bit of difference between various commentators. But all the Jewish ones, and I tend to stick with the Jewish ones, I think they're more reliable with their own language, and they all go for preacher. And actually most of the evangelical ones do too. Young's Concordance, for instance, has preacher. So you've got a little thumbnail sketch now. You've got one godly man, his name is Beeri, and he's a preacher. And he has a son, and he gives his son a name. The name he gives his son is God Saves. And this is in the middle of a really rotten, immoral, decadent, violent, ignorant nation. Once we had a student, I think, in Germany, who came from Reno, Nevada. And I think he was boasting a little bit, and I don't think he meant it all that seriously, but he would never say Reno, he would always call it Sin City. So here we've got Sin City, if you like, and in Sin City, which is really given over to everything that is evil, there is one man who's a preacher, and he's got a kid, and he calls him God Saves. Suppose that had happened to you, you know, if you'd grown up in Reno, and your dad was a preacher, and he decided to call you Jesus Saves. And everywhere you went, that was your name. And when you went to school, and the teacher called the roll, and she would say, Jesus Saves, and you would say, yeah, and all the kids would go, Jesus Saves, boy. It would be pretty hard to grow up with that kind of thing, but Hosea didn't rebel against it. He was a good son, he was loyal to his father, and he desperately wanted to serve God. And from his youngest days, as far as we can tell, Hosea was obedient. And we meet him at the threshold of his career. And he's looking, as soon as you're looking, what is God's will for my life? Lord, what do you want me to do? Lord, what would you like me to become? Verse 2. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, go, take to yourself an adulterous wife and children of unfaithfulness, because the land is guilty of the vilest adultery in departing from the Lord. Hey, that's an interesting mission, isn't it? Would you be a little bit surprised if you discovered that that was God's will for your life? And the word in the NIV here, adulterous, is rather kind. Go and find a prostitute and marry her, and she'll give you children that won't be yours. That was God's command to Hosea. We'll look at it a little bit more closely tomorrow, just because of the way time is going. I'm used to 1 hour lectures and I'm going to fit into 45 minutes here. So, that was God's mission for Hosea. And he went and did it. Verse 3, so he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim. And she conceived and bore him a son. He didn't argue, just did as he was told. So he married Gomer. And her name means heat. Probably in the sense of lust. She was hot stuff. And then she had a father, and he was called Diblaim. That's very interesting. His name means double-minded or double-hearted. That's the only thing we know about him, his name and who his daughter was. Not told anything else. Double-minded, double-hearted. Strange name to grow up with, wasn't it? You see, Diblaim never really decided what he wanted to do with his life. Part of him really wanted to serve God, and he really did. But part of him really wanted to join in some of the things that the very godless people did. And he was pulled two ways, and he never really decided. He tried to ride the fence all his life. He was a double-minded man. One day it'd be this way, and the next day it'd be that way. Anybody here like that? No, of course you wouldn't be, would you? In Bible school, we don't have people like that in Bible school, or do we? Part of you really wants to serve the Lord, and part of you really wants to go on, live it up in Mexico on a motorbike. Let's just follow the idea of being double-minded through for a little bit. James chapter 1. You can turn to this one. James chapter 1, verse 5. If any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. If you don't know, then ask. But when he asks, he must believe and not doubt, because he who doubts is like a wave of the sea blown and tossed by the wind. That man should not think that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all he does. So the double-minded man never receives anything from God in prayer because he never knows what he wants. I mean, today he's asking for spiritual blessing, tomorrow he'll be wanting to get off the spiritual hook and go and live it up, you know. And he doesn't really mean it when he asks God for that blessing, because it's only half-hearted. And God says, you shall seek me, and you'll find me when you seek with all your heart. And I'll guarantee there are people here in this school, and you have never really found God. You might have had your sins forgiven, but you don't really know him. And the reason you don't know him is that you only seek half-heartedly. You've never really made up your mind what you want. And God says, you'll seek me and find me when you seek with all your heart. We'll expand on that again a bit too. James chapter 4, verse 8. James 4:8. Come near to God, and he will come near to you. Wash your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Not just wash, purify your hearts. Wash your hands of evil deeds, but purify your hearts. And there is a promise of Jesus, which we'll not turn to. It's Matthew chapter 5 and verse 8, where it says this. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. It's a tremendous promise, isn't it? Blessed are the pure in heart, they shall see God. It's not talking about heaven. It's talking about now. You seen him lately? What does it mean to be pure? If we dig some ore out of the hillside, mine it, it's covered in clay, it's dirty. Hose it down and wash off all the clay, and it's clean. It's not pure, but it's clean. Being pure doesn't just mean you get all the dirt out. Being pure means you're 100%. Pure metal, nothing else. You don't just wash off the dirt, you put it through the fire and refine it till it's 100% metal, and then it's pure. I tried to get this point over once to a farmer who lived... Any of you come across a book or a TV series, All Creatures Great and Small, or that one, James Herriot and that mob? Well, if you have... This farmer lives in the house that they use for the TV series. He's not a vet, he's a farmer. But it's a nice house for the series. And I held a week of meetings there, stayed with that family. And the wife is a very keen Christian. The husband never really made up my mind about him, because I don't think he ever really made up his mind either. And he was always too busy to come to any of the meetings. So I asked him if he'd come and help me in Sunday school. And said he would. They were 5, 6, 7 year old, so I didn't think it could do him too much harm. So he came along with me to the Sunday school, brought his shotgun. And we had 2 cartridges for the shotgun, and we had 2 firecrackers. And we talked a little bit about being pure in heart with the kids. And then we did a little experiment, and we got a firecracker, and we broke it open, and we shook out all the gunpowder onto a little piece of paper and put it on the bench. Then we broke open one of the shotgun cartridges, emptied all the shot out onto a little piece of paper, picked out the shot and left the gunpowder. Then I said to the kids, which of these two has more gunpowder, the shotgun cartridge or the firecracker? They decided the firecracker had got more gunpowder than the shotgun cartridge. So then we went outside. And we put the firecracker, the other firecracker, identical to the one we'd opened, on a wall. And we lit the fuse, and we all stood back, and it sparked for a minute, and it went bang! And all the kids roared and clapped, and they thought it was the best Sunday school lesson they'd ever had. And then we put the shotgun cartridge into the shotgun, and the farmer took aim at a Coke can 30 yards away in a tree. Fortunately, it was a pretty good shot. And he blasted the Coke can out of the tree, and one of the lads ran, fetched it, and brought it back, and it was riddled with little holes punched in it by the shot. Then we looked for the firecracker, and it was still sitting on the wall, just where it had exploded. I said to the kids, why is it, if the firecracker had more explosive than the shotgun cartridge, that the firecracker is still sitting on the wall, it's not gone anywhere, but the shotgun cartridge hit this tin, this can, and did this to it 30 yards away? The answer, of course, is that in the gun, all the energy is channeled in one direction, straight down the barrel. Whereas in the firecracker, it's not channeled at all, and it just goes bang in every direction, goes nowhere. And the shotgun is what it is to be pure in heart. It means that the whole of your life is aimed in one direction, and one direction only. And that is His. And Jesus says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And if you are pure in heart, you will see God in the pages of His book. You will see God working in your own heart and life, helping you to handle habits you could never control, and producing or reproducing the fruit of the Spirit within you. The Galatians 5 list, love, joy, peace, etc. You will see Him at work through you in the lives of others, either bringing them to Christ or encouraging Christians in their walk. Really ministering to people. And there is nothing so exciting and nothing so refreshing and so worthwhile as actually seeing God in action. First time God ever used me to lead anybody to Christ was when I was in the army. Might surprise you to know I was in the army. It amazes me to think I ever was. But I was. I got this personal invitation from the Queen, and I didn't like to disappoint her. So here I was in the army for 2 years. And as new recruits, it was kind of rough. He had to wear his horrible uniform. It was hairy and itchy and mud-colored and horrible. But you had to wear it, and you weren't allowed to run wearing the uniform unless you were ordered to, and then you weren't allowed to stop. But you weren't supposed to, and we had 5 minutes for a coffee break. And in 5 minutes in a coffee break, in between endless sessions of instruction and drill and things, 5 minutes over a cup of coffee, I led a guy to Christ, first one. And actually, I didn't do it in 5 minutes, it took six, which meant I was late, which meant I had to run. I felt like running anyway. And I came out of there and I was so excited, I ran down the street, leapt up into the air, clicked my heels, and shouted yippee or something, and got arrested by the military police. And I got dragged into the military police office by the corporal who arrested me, took me to a sergeant, said, this man is running down the road, sergeant, and jumping, what's more. And the sergeant looked very fierce, and he said, what were you doing that for? And I said, well, let me tell you, see, Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world, and I just seen Him save a guy over there over coffee break, and I've never seen anything like it. And the experience, let me recommend it to you. Do you know Jesus? He said, corporal, get this man out of here and never bring him back. And I ran the rest of the way down to the barracks. And there is nothing so really refreshing, so wonderful, as actually seeing God in action. And Jesus says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Of the two men who accomplished most in the scriptures, Old Testament and New Testament, apart from Jesus Christ, Old Testament is David, New Testament is Paul. David says this, one thing have I desired of the Lord, just one. I know exactly what I want. One thing have I desired from the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in his temple and behold his beauty and inquire of him. Might sound like three things, but he'd said it was one. Paul, Philippians, that's Psalm 27, verse 4. Paul, Philippians 3, 17. This one thing I do, forgetting those things that are behind me, reaching out to what's before me, I press toward the mark of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. One thing. There were men whose lives characterized what it is to be pure in heart. Both of them made up their minds where they were going. They were pressing in that direction. And that's why they were the two men who saw most happen. On the other hand, there was Diblaim, who never made his mind up. And all we know about Diblaim is that he had a daughter who was a prostitute, and her name was Lust. I'd like you to take down this little sentence. In the divided heart, in the divided heart, the sensual always swallows the spiritual. Okay? In the divided heart, the sensual always swallows the spiritual. If you don't make up your mind, you'll be like Diblaim, and the end product of your life will always be the wrong one. Guaranteed. If you don't decide and really decide and set your heart on that, you can guarantee that the end result of your life will be the same as his. And the only thing that Diblaim ever achieved was to produce a prostitute. So, it's an interesting family, isn't it? We've got a father who's a preacher. We've got a son whose name is God Saves, or Jehovah Saves, literally. His wife is called Lust. She's a prostitute. And they live in this absolutely rotten community. And God is going to use this man, Hosea, to accomplish his own purposes. Then, 750 years before Christ, and now, nearly 2,000 years afterwards, still using him. And it's interesting, I just had a little count up. I know at the moment of seven pastors who are former students of Cape May schools and are currently preaching their way through Hosea using some crummy notes that they picked up while they were in Bible school. But it's very much a message for our times, and you'll find that this man will really communicate to your heart. He was in an unenviable situation with a very tough task. No doubt there are all kinds of questions in your mind. Save them for, you know, about, is it ever right for a man of God to marry a prostitute? Isn't that against the law? Etc., etc. Save it for three lectures and then come if you're still baffled after the three lectures. Okay, let's pray together.